your hosts. I'm Diane Bortoletto.
And I'm Monique Chicardo.
Let's do it.
Hello, hello, and welcome to And Away We Go, a Formula One podcast that goes beyond the track limits to talk about travel, food, and lifestyle surrounding the sport. I'm Diane Bortoletto, your pre-Drive to Survive Formula One fan, and today I'm in Perth in Western Australia.
And I'm Monique Chicardo, your post-Drive to Survive fan, currently in Stavanger in Norway. So this week, we're actually doing something a little bit different with the first of our off-season interviews. So while we're not racing, we'll be inviting interesting people with a connection to Formula One on to have a chat.
Our very first guest is a friend of mine who I've known for a couple of years now. I'm delighted to introduce Jason Best. Jason is the head chef at Supper Road, which is the premier catering business in the southwest of Western Australia. Jason is the former chef of the Mercedes Formula One team. So welcome, Jason.
Hi, Monique. Cheers for having me.
Now, Jason, can you tell us, just how does one get into cooking for Formula One, cooking for the Mercedes Formula One team?
Very much a case of, for me anyway, I was in the right place at the right time. I was doing some chef work in London and through an agency. And that agency used to send me to a catering company called Rocket Food, who are a big events and wedding caterer in London. And I'd done a bit of work for them over the years here and there. And I was actually just having a Friday arvo beer with the owner of the agency. And she got an email at the same time saying, we need a chef to go to Abu Dhabi. This was end of 2012 season. And I was like, make sure you put my name forward for that. I would love to go. And she's like, okay, I'll put your name forward and see what they say. One of the girls who was working on there, Justine, she was like, yeah, Jace would be great.
So did you have an interest in Formula One before putting your hand up for that?
I love sport in general. So I always kept an eye on it. I think at that time or just before that, Mark Webber was pretty prominent in Australian racing that way. Yeah. So I'd always, I liked Webber. And at that time, he was going through some pretty interesting interviews when he was racing for Red Bull. And probably his and Seb Vettel's relationship was quite interesting at that time.
So, Jason, you were at Mercedes during their heyday when they were just on their massive winning streak. What was that like to be part of such a formidable team?
Yeah, it was interesting because the first race I did was end of 2012. And that was still when Michael Schumacher was driving for Mercedes. And actually in that race, I remember Lewis Hamilton coming into the back of the kitchen to speak to Michael because they were discussing, I guess, the changeover. Like there'd already been, the decision had basically just been made that Lewis was taking over and Michael was retiring. I thought that was it for me, but then I ended up getting asked to come back the following year, and that was 2013. And at that stage, Mercedes were probably eyeing to try and get third position overall for the constructors. And it was starting to get a bit more pretty serious in there, expectations and things like that. And then I remember that end of that year, they were like, we're pretty confident. Internally, they were pretty confident they were going to give it a good crack for the 14th season. And that's what happened. It was full on. I noticed the changes each season I came back. So the demand was greater for everybody, especially for us working in hospitality. And I'm sure on the mechanics and everything too, but. Yeah, all of a sudden the media was much bigger because the media would eat in our hospitality Friday, Saturday, Sunday. That was a major part of who we're cooking for. But the media could choose whatever team they went into, really. But then all of a sudden everyone just wanted to be in the Mercedes, in Mercedes Land. So we had to make sure, I guess it was a food, since everything was top notch.
Yeah. I remember working, for Rally Australia back in the World Rally Championship. And it was the same setup for the rally teams there. They would have a buffet out for every lunch and the media could just sort of swan in, wander in and choose whichever team they wanted to lunch with. And, so you always kind of did the rounds to see what was out and then just decide where you were going to stop for lunch, depending what was on the menu.
Yeah. I reckon,
or who you wanted to be around.
I reckon like the three big ones would probably us, Red Bull, and even McLaren at the time had a really good offering. And Lotus and obviously and Ferrari too.
So how many people would you have been cooking for at that time when you were, everyone was coming in?
I reckon Friday was always like the biggest day. So I'll tell you, like a basic Friday, you come in, do breakfast, but that was generally just for the team. And like, but the team extends to marketing, PR, all the mechanics, engineers, technicians, yeah, and so on. So that would be about on average, probably be just over 100 for the team. And then lunch would kick off because you'd have the team for lunch too, then media, which again, on average, be anywhere between 100 and sometimes even 180, depending on what you're at and who and what was popular at the time, what was going on.
Yeah, right. That 180 people, that's a lot. Yeah.
And then VIPs could be anywhere from 15 to 50.
Right. Wow. And did they all have the same menu? Like, were you cooking the same? Drivers eat the same food as the VIPs and the media and the mechanics, or did the drivers have separate menus?
Yeah, drivers just had special diets. Yeah, so I guess my role, one of my main roles in the 2014 season was looking after the drivers' food and working with their personal trainers, and they were Lewis and Nico Rosberg in that year. And it was kind of really full on because they were both neck and neck going for that world title, and the constructors obviously was doing really well. But those two were, it probably got portrayed in the media that they were like, was pretty against each other. And to be honest, it did actually feel like that sometimes. But they were supposedly good mates when they were younger too.
And Lewis Hamilton won the 2014 World Championship,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. But no, I think they still got on really well. I think it's just so competitive.
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, you just hear the way Nico Rosberg, who's a commentator now, speaks about Lewis and about Mercedes, and he always speaks about the team and about Lewis with such respect and admiration, which when I first heard him speaking about Lewis that way, I was quite surprised because you're right, the media really did pit them against each other. Oh, fabulous. Like, how exciting. Like, did you just wake up every day and pinch yourself going, this is my job?
Definitely to start with, the first couple of races, you'd see someone like Lewis or even Nico walk into the kitchen or walk through. You'd be like, oh. And then, but I guess towards the back end of it, you know, it's just like, it's just part of your job and it didn't really faze you.
What sort of things would the personal trainers request? Did Lewis Hamilton have a really specific menu? Did Nico Rosberg have a really specific menu?
Yes, they did, but it wasn't like difficult. Either. Like a lot of times you'd be making sure you had like nicely cooked potatoes, a lot of carbs. It's like Nico, like they changed a little bit each season or like each point through the season to whatever, like they'll, cause they also chat to their, I think they had like a nutritionist as well who they would speak to. But yeah, like Nico would be sitting in the car eating like a container full of just like roast potatoes before he'd race.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is before Lewis Hamilton became vegan, right?
Yeah, because I think he was going that way, but I was still doing, I remember still doing like salmon for him a lot. But he wouldn't eat a lot of meat, but on a Friday after practice, he would eat, quite often he would have a steak, but that would be the only time he would do that.
Yeah, right.
And
did they ever wander into the kitchen, the drivers just wander in and go, oh, you know, I really have a craving for pancakes or I really feel like a Thai beef salad. Like, would they ever give you requests last minute or was it always kind of pre-planned?
Yeah, Nico would a bit. He was pretty open to walking. He had like a bit of a, he had a really good bond with us and stuff. He was really cool. And so, and along with his trainer, Daniel, they were really close. He would come and tell me like, Jase, I didn't like that. Or he'd be like, that was great. He was pretty upfront. So you always knew where you stood. I think that's kind of good.
Yeah, totally. It's great to have that kind of relationship with the drivers and the people you're cooking for.
Yeah.
Like, what do you remember what Nico Rosberg particularly liked?
I have to make these like muffins for him. And I thought they were the most basic thing. But he was like, these muffins are the best. And like one time he actually texted me personally, like, well, out, not out in a race week. And he's like, can you please send me the recipe for those muffins?
Still got the recipe for those muffins? Yeah, we might need to share that.
And actually, we'd have to say it was actually Justine who was the first head chef. She was the one who like started that, and then we kind of just kept changing the recipe slightly and putting like different stuff. But it had no like it was just like a health muffin. There was no butter or anything in it. It was just like I think maple syrup was like the weird thing that was in it, and like quinoa.
So obviously, being athletes, they have to have quite a healthy sort of menu. Did you find that mostly you were sticking to very stringent?
Yeah.
So there was no, they're going to get a Pavlova this week. It was quite.
on a Sunday arvo after the race, Nico would have like a caramel slice or something like that. You know what? Actually, he loved a carbonara. He loved a carbonara. That was like his.
Oh, good man. Good man. All the good people love a carbonara.
You just jogged my memory then from that. Like, I haven't thought about that for a while.
Please tell me you don't put cream in your carbonara.
The worst part, Di, which you're going to love, was with gluten-free pasta.
Oh, look, I can deal with that. I can, I've been gluten sensitive for a period of time, so I can kind of deal with that, but I can't deal with cream in the carbonara. No, no, no.
That is not a carbonara. We are Italian. That is not a carbonara. That is creamy pasta.
You've got to use the pasta water.
You use pasta water. Good man.
Some people put pasta. Yeah, that's traditional, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yep. Yeah, using that fat to emulsify. Anyway, so did you get out of the hospitality suite and the kitchen to go shopping for food?
Yeah, I can remember being in like a shopping center in Japan and Singapore and stuff like that, places like that. And I remember finding Japan hard because I didn't speak any Japanese, but you just wing it, seemed to make it work. But Japan was actually really good because the meat, like the beef quality was like out of control. A lot of the stuff, we would just go find ourselves for that rice.
Yeah, wow. So how much were you having to buy then? I can't imagine that it's just one person pushing a trolley around.
No, it's not. It's just be like bits and bobs. Like we actually did, what we would do in London is do a pallet up of like dry goods, and we'd get them flown, air freighted to each destination. So you would have that core group of basic dry goods, because all the mechanics and stuff are all English, right? So like, they're just things like HB sauce and stuff like that they needed to have. And like porridge oats and things like, just like basics, you know, just stuff like that. And obviously your flours and sugars and everything would go over as well.
Yeah.
So that sort of stuff could get harder when you're in international locations like Malaysia or Brazil, and stuff starts getting harder. So you're just trying to get your fresh food when you're an international destination, I guess. And they provided us with a contact on the ground that would help organize that.
What was the hardest destination that you found to go shopping in, aside from Japan?
India? Yeah.
Tell us about that.
That was the 2013 season. I think that was the last time they've been there too. That was eye-opening because I love F1, but I felt like it shouldn't have been there. It was hard. You'd be driving into the track and there was just people on the roads and, you know, walking cows down the roads. And you just know how much money is getting spent there. And it kind of made me feel a bit funny, I think. Is that fair to say? I don't know.
I get that.
Yeah. But then it was so interesting. People just rocking in with their cars with full of food in the boot.
Trying to sell it.
I was like, if that happened over here, your restaurant would get shut down.
Pulling up in their 1982 Toyota Corolla, lifting up the boot to give you a bag of rice.
That definitely wasn't one of the glamour races that we did, but you've got to do it and make sure the mechanics are at least getting a decent feed. And that was stressful through times, I can remember.
Oh, no. And like, did you ever have time to get out and eat the local food? Like,
yeah, for sure. You know, yeah.
Enjoy an Indian. Yeah.
Yeah. Now India was a bit weird. We were in like it's almost like a compound, like just of apartments, but like a resort. If any, had like a golf course in there and stuff like that. So it was actually like, it was nice where we're staying. And that's why I was like, we're going out of this area and then driving. And you're seeing what India is actually like once you go out of there. And,
yeah, right.
But you know, that was because it was near Delhi from memory, just a couple of hours out of Delhi, I think.
What was the cooking setup that you had? You mentioned that in Europe there was you had a motorhome that actually went to all the races in Europe.
Yeah, Europe was different setup for everything almost. We had one truck that we called the fridge truck, so that we would load before a race. We had a freezer on board, so we had a lot of meat cryback. Yeah, then the motorhome, which was like the hospitality. Each team had their own motorhome hospitality. Each team's was different depending on how much money they wanted to spend on it. But you had an allocated area and you could do pretty much what you wanted. Like I'd love to see what they're doing now. They're probably even like way better than when I was doing it. But they're pretty spectacular. They were like three levels, the one we were cooking out of on 2014.
Wow. So, yeah. Gosh, like, three levels.
Yeah, like the ground level would be your main, where the team or the media would all come in and eat, and there'd be like a big unit, like come and get a coffee. And on the other side of that would be like where all the food would be. And then behind that would be where the kitchen was.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was just, it wasn't big.
And that's like in a shipping container, like shipping container size, is it? And then it kind of folds out. Like
They used to have these, a group called, they used to call them the truckies, and they would bring everything around and set the hospitality up. But it was all out of sea containers, essentially. You're right. Out of trucks.
Wow.
And they would just build that each, like Monday and Tuesday they would build so that it was ready to go by Wednesday morning. But we'd be cooking out of it on Tuesday.
Yeah, that's insane. Yep.
That's a big operation, isn't it? Like for so many races every year. And I've seen the inside of the Supper Road trucks that where Jason works now.
Supper Road ones are better.
The Supper Road ones are better?
Yes, especially the big one.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To be honest, the truck we have, the main truck we have at Supper Road was better than the main kitchen we had in Europe for sure.
Yeah, right.
Wow. I assume with all of this being such a big operation, the whole motorhomes traveling and, you know, having to get your stuff sent over, all your dry goods sent over and shipped around, stuff's bound to go wrong, right? Did anything go wrong?
Well, the same with the dry goods, we'd have equipment that had to get sent around all over the world too. So you'd have equipment.
Yeah.
We'd go to the Mercedes factory in Brackley, and then we would go through all the equipment like ovens. I think we would send a fryer, but mainly ovens and stovetops, and then all the utensils and everything, KitchenAids. Thermomix actually had its own personal freight. They would go in and just get sent across to each. There'd be about six of them that would just go from one. So one would go to Australia, then that one would maybe go to like Singapore after that. You have to do electric checks on everything to make sure everything was at standard. But as far as things going wrong, I remember things did go wrong.
Did things ever not turn up?
Yeah, food would not turn, or you'd have to, like, your food would have got sent somewhere else and you'd have to find it and get it back over, and that's things like that. Logistics was a massive part of the job. Massive.
Yeah, I could imagine. I mean, if you're going to, you know, this year it was 24 races in a season. So if you're trying to get around from country to country every weekend, I can imagine logistics is probably 95% of the job.
Yeah, for sure was. Yeah, definitely was. That is probably what helped me with Supper Road initially as well, is those logistics, because we have similar logistical things that are massive about our job now. It was very helpful,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah. You're obviously, what you do now with Supper Road is, it's on a big scale, but it's not the intensity and the craziness of Formula One. So you've had the perfect preparation for what you do now.
I don't know, Jason. They cater for weddings. I mean, you know, bridezillas are a real thing, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, you're right. On the day, like, people would get freaked out by Toto Wolff coming to the buffet. I can remember, say there was a tomato and mozzarella salad out on the buffet. As soon as he'd come up, they'd be like, put more basil on there, like, just going over the top. Like, it was, sometimes I'd like shake my head a little bit.
Calm down, guys. It's just Toto Wolff.
Everyone was very scared of Toto Wolff. He was actually really nice.
What's Toto like?
He was just like, he was very, very German. Well, Austrian, isn't he?
Very German.
Yeah. He was a very serious guy, but I didn't really get to speak to him very much, to be honest. He was always polite and come and say thank you and things like that. It's like,
oh, good. Oh, good.
But yeah, everyone, he had an aura, definitely, though. Different aura about him.
Yeah. And I'm sure you would have heard if things weren't good. For that job, did you have a favourite team or favourite driver? And do you have one now?
I think I have to be loyal to Oscar Piastri, my new favourite driver.
Yeah, you do.
It's good to see McLaren back up there as well. I think that's cool. Before that, you know, obviously when I was a kid, I used to remember Schumacher all the time because he was always winning. So obviously Ferrari is pretty exciting back in the day. They've had a pretty good year this year too, which is good. Yeah, Mark Webber would be my all-time favourite driver, for sure.
Oh, Mark Webber. Right. And do you watch as many races as you can when you're not catering for weddings or working on weekends?
I actually got back into it this year. I pretty much the KO Minis quite a lot after the race.
Yeah.
On the, like, Sunday night or Monday morning.
So do you watch the races on TV, and when they're in the paddock or in the garage or whatever, do you see people and go, oh my God, yeah, look at them. I worked with them.
Yeah, so there's still quite a few people that were working in hospitality enough, but now actually have got out of hospitality and working like in different areas, like PR and marketing. One of the girls who worked with us, so she's actually like Melissa's main PR person now for Mercedes. So that's pretty cool to see them move up through the ranks. And then a lot of the mechanics are still there, still the same thing. Yeah, which is, and they're know, they got a good job.
That's so cool that they've worked their way up through the ranks. So you can basically enter the Formula One world any which way and kind of set your sights on a different role or something.
For sure.
A lofty kind of role.
Yeah, for sure. If you're driven like any in any job or career, like you should definitely move up through the ranks.
Jason, where is your favourite race destination to visit and why did you enjoy visiting there?
One of my favourite races was Monaco because I had my birthday there 2 years in a row, 13 and 14. And it was quite a special place as well. It's very unique compared to all the other races. Well, every race is unique, I guess, but that being a street circle through Monaco is pretty cool. And there's a bit of history there as well. And all the boats and the marina and super yachts. It's, yeah, pretty amazing. Everything's going on there, the league.
It's the race of races, isn't it? It's the biggest race in the calendar. It's the race every driver wants to win and have that on their motorsport CV.
I think as a destination, it's a really fascinating place too, because everyone has this idea that Monaco is just glitz and glamour and fast, expensive cars and super yachts, which it is. But then you go to the other side of town, which it's a very, very small place. You can literally walk there. And you go to the other side of town and you've got the local markets and you've got, you know, the little local bistros where you can get pizza and a pint for actually cheaper than where we were buying pizzas and pints in Villefranche-sur-Mer, which is in France.
Yeah.
You know, it was cheaper to eat out in Monaco than it was in Villefranche. So I think it's a fascinating place because people forget that real people live in Monaco.
Yeah.
And, you know, just everyday people live in Monaco.
Sure.
I remember when I went to the Grand Prix in Monaco, which was, 2014, one of the years that Jason was working there and having his birthday there. I remember underneath our grandstand, there was a little Heineken bar. It was tiny. It was literally a keg with one Heineken tap and a guy there. And it was €8 pints, which wasn't excessive at the time. That was quite reasonable. And there was never a queue. We had the best day. It was so much fun. And Daniel Ricciardo came second that day. I remember that.
Did you spend much time at Razzcas? Was that main bar on the corner? You know, the main, have the fine point before they come back on the straight.
No, I didn't. I remember there was just people everywhere. It was pretty busy.
Yeah.
But no, we didn't. We didn't really. We kind of walked after the race. We walked around. We had a couple of drinks in, I want to say, kind of like a park. There was an outdoor kind of festival going on and people dancing and whatever. And then we caught the train back to Nice.
Yeah.
So it's so easy to get into Monaco. And it's fun because you guys are talking about all these different spots on the racetrack. And I know exactly what you're talking about, even though I haven't been to the race. It's because I've walked the track twice.
Yeah.
Both times we went to Monaco, the first thing we did was we got off the train and walked around the racetrack. So I can picture it in my mind.
The train was so easy from Nice. And because our trip to the Monaco Grand Prix was a last minute decision, like we only decided it was less than 2 weeks before the race. So we had to make all of the travel arrangements. We had to pick up our tickets. So we walked out of the Monaco train station and I was like, okay, we need to find the Monaco motorsport governing body that was had the tickets. And it was right opposite the train station. I was like, oh, that's easy. And again, I think we only had to wait like 2 minutes, picked up our ticket. And actually the next day we went back to Monaco as well, caught the train from Nice and did exactly what you did, Mum. We walked the track, which I just found kind of amazing that we were actually even allowed on the track. Like all the roads were still closed. They were still packing down barriers and stuff. And I remember we were walking through the tunnel and I was like, oh my God, this just feels surreal that yesterday there were 20 Formula One cars and then there was the Formula Two before that and the other support races screaming through the tunnel just the day before. It felt really surreal.
I think that's one of the coolest things about the street tracks like Monaco is that even if you're traveling to these destinations and it's not Formula One, you can print out the map yourself and walk around and you recognize it all.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, there are certain spots in Monaco where you get to and you're like, oh my God, iconic. Like the hairpin turns and the tunnel and, you know, going up through Place de Casino and however you say it in beautiful French accent, you know, you walk through those spots and you're like, oh my God, wow. Like it's exactly, you've seen it before. So it's really cool. Monaco is a good choice.
Yeah, there's lots of others. They all stick out. But yeah, I guess I've got special memories of it. Well, Well, but for lack of memory or something.
Were you able to like extend your trip when you were there for work? Like,
I reckon the schedule's more hectic now. There's a few more races in it. But we were allowed to do, I can't remember exactly what we were allowed to do four, like when we'd finish a race, we could fly somewhere of our choice and they would look after that. I think it was three or four through the year. So usually you would do that in like the international one to away from Europe. We went to Texas and I actually flew out early. I flew to New York and I had a week there, I think, and then flew down from New York to Nashville and had 2 nights in Nashville, then flew to Nashville to Texas and had a couple of nights there before we had to be on Shark the Race. So that was a pretty awesome experience. I made the most of that little period, seeing a bit of America, which I hadn't really done before. So that one. Really enjoyed that. Austin, Texas was amazing. That was a good raceway for sure. There's lots to do in Austin. Highly recommend.
Awesome. I was going to say, are there any destinations on the race calendar now that weren't race destinations when you were cooking that you were like, damn, I wish I could have worked at that one?
Yeah, I've like Vegas and Miami. I've seen those ones now because they're obviously it became more popular in America. They're two that I reckon would have been pretty cool to go to.
Sure.
And Mexico.
Mexico. I want to go to Mexico.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the one race that I'm like, oh my God, I really want to go. And it's such a stupid reason. I really want to see the mariachi bands playing the Formula One theme song.
Yeah. No, I reckon Mexico looks great. I would like to speak to some people that are still working on and see how that race is behind closed doors, even with just sourcing food and stuff like that and how it'll pretty much the same, how that all works.
Yeah, but also like Mexican food and just the whole kind of culture surrounding Mexico is so vibrant and fascinating. Yeah. So if you were working in hospitality, I think it would be really, really fun to go to the markets or to, I don't know, have a little Mexican flair on what you're cooking that week or.
Yeah, they'd definitely be doing like a taco night with mechanics and stuff like that there for sure.
Oh, yeah, but everyone loves a taco, right?
What else I've been thinking about recently is that I didn't really, before I started working for them, I didn't realize the people like Niki Lauda, who they were and things like that, getting to like do basic cooking for him because he couldn't eat a lot at the time. But seeing guys like him day in, day out and then working and then looking into what they did more was really interesting. And like that movie came out as well about him. That was all while I was kind of working on it around that time. I think learning and meeting some of these people that were involved with Mercedes was pretty epic experience that I probably didn't really think too much about at the time, but now I reckon it's pretty cool.
Yeah. It must be crazy to have this realization that this person that you keep seeing every day and serving them their pasta or whatever you cooked for them and then realizing, oh my gosh, they're actually someone that's, you know, super, super important in the sport or super well known, or oh my gosh, there's the, you know, the Prince of Dubai or like that must be so crazy.
Yeah. I remember like in Singapore one year, actually David Beckham came in and it was really late on the Sunday. We pretty much had no food left. And we were like in Queen Down mode and we were running around the paddock he just wanted a cheese ball and we literally just cleaning everything out. And I was like, it's David Beckham. So we had to like run around. I think we found some cheese at Ferrari and a few other teams and whipped him up a quick cheese board. It was out, just things like that. I was just like, oh, it's pretty quite funny. And we would have had cheese, but it was like, we were almost out of there because it was weird. Singapore's weird, it was always really late. That was actually a really difficult race to work because the time zones were. Because the night and being a night race, it was really, your body was so out of sync.
Yeah, I could imagine. And, you know, when you're having requests like, I want a cheese board from David Beckham at stupid o'clock at night, you're probably like,
oh. Yeah, it's just a cheese board, but like, it was so much harder than it.
If one team's going to have cheese, it'd be the Ferrari team, you'd think, wouldn't it? So, you know, and like, you went to the right
place.
Most
of the teams are in the same boat as us, you know, like they were almost, but we managed to find. We had a little bit of something, but we just needed a few more varieties.
You couldn't just give him some bigger cheese?
No.
Or one of Nico Rosberg's health muffins.
No, I don't think Irene came for that.
So have you still got that health muffin recipe?
I probably do have it somewhere, if I can find.
We might ask you to dig that out for us, and I don't know, maybe Mon and I can have a cook-off of the health muffin.
I wonder if he's still eats them. He's probably, he has an ice cream store in Ibiza. He's probably just lounging out on.
Well, he probably doesn't need to be so strict with his diet now that he's, you know, behind the microphone and instead of behind the steering wheel. So he probably doesn't need to watch what he eats so much.
No.
Are you planning to go to Melbourne, Jason, or to the Grand Prix or not?
No.
Because you could, you know, cook up a batch and get them sent over to Sky Sports.
I did go to Melbourne after I first moved back. That was actually pretty cool. I had full paddock access as a guest. So that was...
Wow.
Yeah, it was cool. I was on the other side. I went down and sat in the VIPs with Mercedes and ate lunch and stuff. And there was people I used to work with were cooking for and stuff like that. And that was pretty fun. And got to, you know, went and did like the watch qualifying. And Nico actually got me those tickets in. That was pretty cool.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, that was pretty awesome of him to do that.
Oh,
yeah.
What a good work.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. All right. Let's move into the final three. So, Jason, these are three questions that we're going to ask all of our podcast guests, and you're the very first. So the first question is, if you could travel to any Formula One destination, race week or not, current or former, what would you choose?
I'm going to say Mexico after that. In check before.
Mexico sounds like a good choice. And then if you could holiday with any Formula One driver, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
Holidaying wise would be Dan Ricciardo because he'd be good fun, always happy, good vibes.
Good music too. He's really into his music. So I'm sure that the road trip tunes would be, you know, cranking and good choice.
And you'd have a holiday wardrobe too with his enchanté.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the last question, if you could cook a Formula One themed meal, like the cuisine from an F1 race destination, what would you cook and why?
I think I would do like from the Austrian Grand Prix, like do like an Austrian sort of vibe night with like schnitzels and goulash and broth with dumplings and that sort of thing. I think that'd be pretty cool fun. And you'd be able to get the Jaeger out as well and enjoy. Have to do it on a Winx's night though, I reckon.
I can back this one up because I've cooked for the Austrian Grand Prix as well. And I made the dumplings in the broth. Well, the first time I ever did, I made schnitzel, of course, because why wouldn't you? That is like the ultimate Austrian meal. And then the second time I made the dumplings in a broth. And living in Norway, obviously, even during summer, sometimes you get beautiful 10 licorice days. So the dumplings and broth was just the most comforting, homely. And it's not the first thing that people would think to cook from Austria if you're not Austrian, because obviously schnitzel, but it's such a homely and delicious meal. And it's maybe not something I'd cook every day, but for the race, it just felt so right.
What are they like? Are they like little tortellinis in broth, or are they more like potato gnocchi? Or like, what are they? Tell me, what are the dumplings?
I think they do like a range of different ones, hey? Like, you know, I've seen them like kind of like potato-y ones, or just even like almost like doughy.
Yeah. So the ones I made were the doughy kind of ones, and they had bacon and some herbs and stuff in there. And then it's just like a beautiful clear chicken broth and they're really, really filling. They're really big and, quite interesting texture.
Yeah.
Because it's obviously like doughy and bready and in broth. But it was, they were delicious. I would highly recommend.
Yeah, it's not what I expected you to say. You know, when you think of all the F1 races around the world that are famous for their cuisine, like Japan and Italy and to say Austria, it was like, wow, that's different. But I can see why.
That track is really, that track's worth visiting. It's beautiful. Spielberg and the Red Bull Ring. Amazing.
I could imagine.
Is it far out from the city or town? Is it kind of isolated?
I felt like it was quite isolated, but it was in like, it had mountains in the background. It was just amazing. It was quieter place for sure. But I really actually just really enjoyed that. Yeah. Get away from some of the busier ones around that time. So it was still busy on the track, but it was just quite nice coming back, nice places to go for nice runs and stuff like that.
I like that about a lot of the European tracks. They're not right in the heart of like Rome or Vienna or something like that. And the small towns in Austria are actually so beautiful and it's so cheap to buy wine and beer.
Spa was similar as well. Spa was like that, quality town.
Yeah.
A beautiful scenery.
It's so nice as someone, you know, if you're going to travel to a Formula One race,
to be able to see real life and not just these big cities that are replicas of each other with all their Zaras and Dolce & Gabbana stores and all that sort of stuff, and just actually getting to kind of the smaller towns where you see a little bit more of the culture.
Thank you so much, Jason, for coming on And Away We Go F1 podcast. It's been so insightful to hear about your time as the chef with the Mercedes Formula One team. Thank you very much.
No, thanks heaps for having me. It's been great and brought up a few good memories. Really enjoyed chatting with you both.
Thanks so much for listening, guys. If you enjoy our podcast, please rate and review us on your favorite podcast listening app. If you have any questions, comments, you just want to have a chat with us, you can email us at andawaywego f1podcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on all your social media apps, Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, YouTube. Just search for And Away We Go F1 podcast there and have a chat with us.
Thank you, Mon. Thank you, Jason. And just before I sign off, I'm going to read a review that one of our listeners has left us. So please leave your reviews and we'll read one out every week. This review is from Suze K, who said, light and fun, like how they not only chat F1, but also about the great cities that host them. Until next week and until lights out.
It's lights out and away we go.
And Away We Go podcast is produced by Diane Bortoletto and Monique Ciccato.
Let's do it.